Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cabal of the Westford Knight, Templars at the Newport Tower, by David S. Brody, narrated by Ryan Burke. Prologue. Many people discovered America before Columbus, but most of them had the good sense to keep quiet about it. Oscar Wilde. May 1399. Henry Sinclair brushed the sweat off his forehead with the sleeve of his tunic and swatted at a swarm of black flies buzzing around his beard. "It's a beautiful land for sure, but the insects are enough to make a man mad." His wealth, his nobility, his titles, nature cared not a damn for any of them. Not here in this new world and not at home in Scotland. The pests were just as happy to alight on the neck of a prince as on a stable boy. It was a good lesson. His companion grunted a response.
"Curse the fool who dragged us across the ocean, I say. We should be home hunting boar, not dragging our old bones up this hill." He spat. "If God had meant for us to walk, he would not have given us horses, I wager."
Sinclair laughed. James Gunn would never question him in front of the men, but with the others out of earshot behind them on the trail, his old friend would call him a fool without fear of retribution.
"What's wrong, Gunn? Getting too old for a bit of adventure? Should I send you home to sit by the fire? You can gossip with the women."
Gunn straightened in response. His usually pale face was pink from exertion, and his thick chest heaved beneath his chainmail armor. Grinning, he rested his meaty hand on the pommel of his battlesword.
"Not too old to teach a whelp like you a lesson."
Sinclair towered over his lieutenant by almost a full head, but Gunn was as thick as an oak tree and nearly as hard as one. For almost 50 years, since they were old enough to walk, they had wrestled and jousted, sometimes for fun or in anger, sometimes side by side on the battlefield. Laughing, he raised a hand.
"Easy, old friend. Save your strength for when the natives come attacking."
Following a route his mother's Viking ancestors had mapped across the North Atlantic, his party, 220 sailors and craftsmen spread over 12 boats, made land in a place he christened Nova Scotia, after the homeland of his father's people. Native legend here told of a tall, yellow-haired god appearing from the east on a one-winged canoe. Fortunately for Sinclair, he arrived with a sail billowing. The natives who called themselves Micmac were not convinced that he was a god, but neither were they certain otherwise. They allowed him and his men to explore for the summer and encamp over winter. When spring arrived, most of his party returned to Scotland, but he and 23 of his men, including Gunn, remained to continue their exploration, and hopefully complete their mission. Gunn grunted and used his sword to hack his way along the trail, his eyes peering into the woods for hostile natives. Sinclair couldn't resist.
"Gunn, ahead there! Is that a native? With bow and arrow?"
Crouching, Gunn squinted for a few seconds before Sinclair guffawed and slapped him on the back.
"Ha ha! A mere jest, my friend! Having a bit of fun at your expense!"
Gunn shook his sword an inch from his nose.
"Your ancestors rutted with donkeys. Just look at their line."
Pushing the tip away, Sinclair leaned back and laughed. He and Gunn were second cousins.
"Yes, I'm looking at it now. An ugly lot for sure."
They waited for the rest of the men to join them and resumed climbing, single file behind Gunn. He set a brisk pace, which Sinclair easily matched. It was good to be on the move again after a winter of inactivity. They had left Nova Scotia a week ago and sailed southwest, their galley pushed by a gale from the northeast. On the fifth day, they spotted land and took shelter at the mouth of a river. When the storm abated, they spotted smoke rising from a distant hill. Their Micmac guide, Gitpu, believed the hill marked the land of the Penacook, a tribe friendly with the Micmac that occupied the land just to the northwest of the coastal Massachusetts tribe. The hill was the highest in the region and as good a place as any to explore. They rode inland, following the river and a tributary to the base of the rise. He took Gunn and 5 men as well as Gitpu, a lean, leather-skinned man with an uncanny ability to move silently through the woods, to climb the hill and determine whether the land might be a suitable settlement site. He left the other men to guard the galley and its priceless cargo. They neared the top of the hill. Gitbu explained this land was called Nashoba, meaning hill that shakes. Sinclair had not shared this information with the men. They were already skittish at being so far inland in unknown territory. They didn't need the added worry of shaking hills.
"Why come we so far inland, my lord?" Gunn asked.
With the men within earshot, he now addressed Sinclair in a manner befitting his status as Prince of Orkney and Earl of Rosslyn. Gunn asked the question on behalf of the men, who did not dare question their leader directly. Sinclair spoke so all could hear.
"If we aim to make a settlement, we need to be able to defend ourselves, both from the natives and perhaps someday from those at home who might do us harm. It is an unexplored world, this land, but it is only a matter of time before others discover it as we have. God willing, by then, we will have laid a solid claim to it by building villages and fortifications."
He allowed his words to sink in. Others would lust after the natural riches of this new world. Timber to build boats, fur and fish to trade, lands to clear and farm, and the Pope would surely send men in search of the treasures he carried.
"To properly defend ourselves, our settlement best be inland, and it is best on a high hill."
Gunn kicked at the dirt.
"Then this might not be a bad spot. Plenty of fresh water and game, a river to take us to the ocean and power a mill, and already the flowers are blooming."
The rivers and lakes were still frozen in Nova Scotia.
"Hopefully the natives are friends."
A muffled cough escaped Gunn's mouth, interrupting his words. Sinclair chuckled.
"What's wrong, Gunn? Did you swallow an insect?"
But even as he spoke, his instincts told him something was wrong. Gunn turned wide-eyed toward Sinclair, reached up slowly, and closed his thick hand on the shaft of an arrow protruding from the side of his neck.
"Curse it!"
he sputtered, dropping to a knee.
"Get down, man!"
Sinclair bellowed, as another arrow hissed by his ear, thudding into a tree. He wrapped an arm around his friend's side and dragged him quickly behind a thick oak on the side of the trail.
"James, do not pull out the arrow. Easy now."
He gently moved Gunn's hand away. Blood spurted from the wound. Only the arrowhead itself kept the blood from escaping in a torrent. A pit formed in his gut and spread as an anvil on his chest. He had seen many similar wounds. All had been fatal. He took a deep breath, resting a hand on Gunn's shoulder, and called to Gitpu.
"Tell them we come in peace! Tell them your chief, their ally, guaranteed a safe passage!"
The guide had already begun yelling into the woods, the low murmur of the natives conversing with each other, debating their response, cascading down the hill. Sinclair took another deep breath and fought to control his emotions. Gunn would die. It was just a question of how quickly. Only God could help him now. He said a quick prayer to the Virgin Mother.
"Stay down, man," he whispered. "We will wait to hear what the natives offer by the way of explanation." "I pray you release us to pursue the savages, my lord,"
one of his men implored.
"Easy now. Remember, we are in their lands."
And vastly outnumbered. A few seconds passed, then a resonant voice from deep in the woods called out a lengthy response. Gitpu translated, his English surprisingly good.
"He say any friend of Micmac chief is welcome on this land. He say he regret arrow in your man's neck. And he say if your man dead, you may bury him on this hill, and they will honor his spirit."
He exhaled. At least Gunn would be today's only casualty. Coughing, Gunn spit out a mouthful of blood and shook his head.
"I can taste the blood, Henry. It pours down my throat."
He forced a bloody smile.
"If only it were ale."
He reached for Sinclair's hand.
"Take care of the little ones, won't you?"
"Of course, old friend." Leaning closer, he smiled. "This is a sign from God, James. I am sure of it. This is the spot God has chosen for us. We will bury you here, on this hill that shakes, next to this mighty oak, and you will be our sentry in this new land. You will guard it for us, for the true soldiers of God, even as the world around you shakes with turmoil and evil."
He smiled again, again rested a hand on Gunn's shoulder. His eyes moistened.
"And a better sentry Christ himself could not have chosen."
He kissed his friend on the cheek.
You can depend on me, Henry,
he whispered.
In this world and in the next.
His eyes fluttering, he squeezed Sinclair's hand.
God be with you, Henry.
Sinclair bowed his head and crossed himself.
Studying the rough map Gitpu had drawn on a scrap of sailcloth, Sinclair turned away from the men and tried to blink his eyes dry. He would warn Gunn later, once they were back in camp and safe. Taking a deep breath, he refocused on the map. They were about 3/4 of the way up the hill. He had hoped to reach the top and leave a marker in stone at its peak, but Gunn's death changed that. He checked the sun, noting its position in the southwestern sky. Perhaps 4 hours of daylight left. They were a 2-hour march back to camp. He would not ask his men to spend the night in these woods. Just ahead, to the left of the trail, lay an outcropping of rock blown clean of leaves and dirt and pine needles by the summer wind. He examined it and returned to the men gathered around Gunn's body, now wrapped in a brown blanket.
We will bury Sir James just ahead, up the trail a bit.
He motioned to 4 of the larger men.
Carry him, then.
He led the way, already feeling a bit naked without James alongside. Who would he confide in? Who could he trust to do the right thing? Most of all, who would he laugh with after a long day in the field? He sighed and rubbed his tunic roughly over his eyes. In many ways, it was a miracle either of them was still alive after decades on battlefields. They reached the site, and he motioned to Murdoch, the armorist.
You have your tools, do you not? Murdoch, a tall, lean, quiet man with a red beard and sad blue eyes, nodded.
I do, but I brought a single punch, and my mallet.
That will have to do.
As the men took turns digging a grave, Sinclair huddled with Murdoch over the rock ledge. Unfortunately, his 2 expert stonemasons, along with the other artisans in his expedition, were back at camp, guarding the ship. He had taken fighting men with him to explore the hillside. Normally, Murdoch repaired their fighting armor and other weaponry, but he also had experience working with stone. He had been studying the outcrop and pointed out its natural grains and striations to his lord.
I will carve his sword here, using the features of the rock.
Sinclair checked his compass and pointed.
The sword must point north. It will be a signpost for those that follow us to this land.
The armorist nodded.
It shall. The lines in the rock run north and south.
Good.
The armorist set to work. Holding an iron-tipped punch at a steep angle to the bedrock, he raised a heavy mallet and pounded the punch, his aim strong and true. A chip flew from the ledge, leaving a pea-sized indentation in the stone. He examined the punch and looked up to Sinclair.
The rock is hard. Hard as any in Scotland.
Will you be able to finish the effigy?
Murdoch studied the punch a second time.
I believe I shall, but as the punch dulls, the marks will become faint.
The sword is the most important thing. Complete that first, then turn to the effigy and shield.
No knight should be buried without a sword marking his grave, especially a warrior like Gunn. Were they back in Scotland, he would have commissioned a full carving, life-size, of his comrade. But here in the wilderness this would have to do. Gunn would understand. He knew what was at stake.
Murdoch, I want to be certain you understand.
The artisan looked up, his blue eyes on Sinclair's. Sinclair lowered his voice.
This is a memorial to Sir James, but it is also much, much more. His effigy and his shield are of small matter. But it is crucial that the sword markings be clear. It is crucial that no one doubt that this is the sword of a Templar knight.
Chapter 1. September. Present day. Legend is more historical than fact, because fact tells us about one man, but legend tells us about a million men. Cameron Thorne read the words on a promotional flyer taped to the library's book return box, reflecting on them as he jogged up the granite stairs of the yellow brick building. Not bad. A history professor once told him that the historical record was often no more than the product of a single scribe's take on events, shaped by his or her experiences and values, and often slanted by a particular agenda, but the memories of an entire culture created legend. He darted ahead of a mother and a young daughter to hold the library's mahogany door. A pair of blue eyes peered up at him from underneath a pink hooded Red Sox sweatshirt.
"Are you coming to hear the story about Prince Henry, too?"
the girl asked. He smiled. No. I'm just here to return some books.
"You should come listen. People think Christopher Columbus discovered Westford, but it was really Prince Henry."
"Discovered America," the girl's mother corrected. "Westford is just one town in our big country. He discovered America. Or didn't." Cam cocked his head.
"So did he or didn't he?"
The mother shrugged, smiling one of those smiles meant to be friendly but not flirtatious. As a single guy in a town full of soccer moms, he knew the difference.
"Apparently not. I'll know more in an hour."
She pointed to another copy of the same legend flyer, this one hanging in the foyer. That afternoon, a local storyteller was presenting Prince Henry and the Westford Knight, the tale of a Scottish expedition exploring the hills of Westford, Massachusetts in 1398. As the girl skipped ahead, the mother turned and smiled again.
"I could go either way on Columbus, but they're going to have a fight on their hands if they try to debunk Santa Claus."
"Enjoy," he laughed. In addition to returning books, he needed to research some old land records for a client who wanted to put some property into a conservation trust.
Not as earth-shattering as a legend that debunked Columbus's accomplishments, but Cam enjoyed traveling back through the centuries, tracking the history of New England settlers through yellowed maps and feather-pen-written deeds, which is why he became a real estate lawyer in the first place. He strolled into the library's reference section, breathing in the air of a century's worth of leather bindings and worn cloth and dust and furniture polish. A librarian helped him find old maps and spread them on one of the oak tables in the center of the high-ceilinged public room. As he studied them, activity at an adjacent table drew his attention. An elderly couple was sitting opposite a burly, orange-haired man with large hands and nicotine-stained fingers. The man shoved a document across the table at the couple, the words "Quitclaim Deed" in large type across the top. An odd place for a real estate closing, but not unheard of. But something about the elderly couple's body language didn't seem right. Most real estate closings were boring affairs, a stack of papers pushed back and forth across the table. Occasionally, the parties argued over a stain on the carpet or the lawyers tried to justify their fee by haggling over the language of some document that would never see the outside of a file cabinet again. But in his 11 years of practice, he had never seen anyone recoil in fear.
"Just sign at the bottom."
The Scottish accent surprised him, but not as much as the menacing tone.
"Emily and I have no interest in selling."
With his bug eyes and oversized blue cardigan, the man reminded him of Don Knotts in the old Andy Griffith shows. His wife, a thick woman with a round, sunburnt face wearing a floral house dress, nodded in agreement.
"We have an accord, Mr. Chandron,"
the Scotsman snarled, lifting his bulk from his seat.
"You'd be wise to honor it."
A few other patrons glanced over at the outburst. Mrs. Gendron raised her chin but kept her voice low.
"We never agreed to sell, Mr. McClovick."
McClovick slapped his thigh, the sleeve of his white dress shirt protruding from beneath a frayed blue blazer.
"Of course you did. Why else would we be sitting here today?"
We came because you said you had important business to discuss with us,"
Mr. Gendron responded.
"Exactly."
McClovick's face reddened.
"Now I will not be asking you a third time."
Still standing, he shoved the document further across the table, grabbing Mr. Gendron by the wrist as he did so.
"I'm paying you more than a fair price. Now sign the bloody deed."
Cam took a deep breath, stood, and turned slowly toward the trio.
"I couldn't help overhearing. I'm a lawyer. Can I be of any help here?"
He smiled at the older couple, then turned to meet McClovick's hostile stare, while balancing on the balls of his feet with his arms loose by his side. He had been sucker-punched in an elevator once by an angry landlord in an eviction case. Fortunately, an off-duty policeman witnessed the altercation, and Cam was never charged for pummeling the man. But one sucker-punch was enough.
"We're fine here. No need for your services,"
McClovick snarled. Mrs. Gendron spoke after a short pause. She, too, stared at McClovick.
"Actually, I do think it's time we found ourselves a lawyer."
An hour later, Cam left the library, the gendarmes having left safely while McClavick stood in his seat. Cam took the stairs two at a time, ignoring the pain in his knee still bruised and swollen from a rough skydiving landing over the weekend. It would loosen up eventually, though not as quickly as it did when he was in his 20s, or even in his early 30s. He checked his watch. Still time to race over to Wilmington to watch the Bruins training camp practice for an hour before his softball game. He jogged left into the library driveway toward his Harley, parked along a line of trees. One of the few good things about practicing law in the suburbs was he didn't have to worry about some lowlife carting his bike away. As he dug in his jacket pocket for his keys, a thick man stepped into his path from behind a tree. McClavick. Averting his eyes, Cam changed his path to avoid the larger man. McClavick moved with him, his arms folded across his chest. Cam adjusted his course a second time, again mirrored by the Scotsman. Okay, then. Stopping, Cam lowered his briefcase to the ground. You want to dance, McClavick? The man was half a head taller and perhaps 60 pounds heavier.
I grew up on the docks of Glasgow. It's not dancing I have in mind.
McClavick unfolded his arms, freeing his fists.
Where I come from, a man minds his own business.
Then I suggest you go home. Around here, we don't bully our senior citizens. McClavick took a step closer. Cam would rather not have been so close. In a fight, he would need to keep his distance and rely on speed. Plus, McClavick smelled like he hadn't showered in a few days, but he couldn't back away. Tilting his head back, he met the man's glare. They were alone on the side of the building. If McClavick was going to throw a punch, he would do so now. Instead, he leered and jerked a thumb toward the Harley.
Nice bike. Next time you might want to put some air in the tires.
The words hit Cam in an acrid fog of stale cigarettes and coffee. The bastard had slashed his tires. Next time you do something stupid, you might want to make sure there's no security camera around. He tilted his chin toward the device mounted on the side of the library.
I can see why a sharp guy like you left the docks.
He stepped around the bully.
Maybe you should have tried the dancing thing.
Cam met with the gendarmes a couple of days later at the senior center in Westford, where he provided free legal service a few days every month.
Let's start at the beginning, Mr. Gendron. Do you want to sell your house?
He was supposed to meet his mountain biking buddies in half an hour. They wouldn't wait, not with the September daylight fading. He settled back in his chair. He'd catch them on the trail if necessary. Marvin Gendron looked to his wife before answering.
No. We lived in that house since I returned from duty in Vietnam, in 1968. Paid $7,000 for it. A lot of money back then. We have no desire to sell it.
Cam set his pen down. It rolled toward the edge of the laminated banquet table. They were seated in metal folding chairs in a small room of what had originally been a colonial-style school.
Obviously, Mr. McClavick believes otherwise.
He hadn't told them about the encounter outside the library. No reason to alarm them further. Emily fumbled in a canvas tote bag, pulled out a single sheet of paper, and pushed it across the table, her hands marked by dirt caked under her fingernails and calluses on her palms. Probably a gardener.
Why don't we let Mr. Thorne look at the paper? It might help explain things.
As Cam perused the document, he pulled on the whiskers of his goatee. The beard was new to his face. He often found himself plucking hairs, some of them tinting toward gray from his chin. The document was the standard Massachusetts form for making an offer to purchase real estate. A year ago, Cam relocated from Boston and joined his Uncle Peter's suburban law firm in the Neshoba Valley, a half hour northwest of Boston. In that time, he had seen scores of documents just like it. He skipped to the bottom of the page. The offer was signed by McClavick.
You didn't sign this, did you?
No.
Emily reached back into her canvas bag, pulled out three more sheets of paper, and slid them to Cam. He scanned them as well. They were identical to the first except for the purchase price. The original offer was for $325,000. By the fourth offer, the price had climbed to $410,000.
You have gold buried in your yard?
The real estate market, after years of steady increases, had slumped. These increasing offers made no sense, unless the first offer had been a lowball.
What do you think your house is worth?
Emily turned to Marvin.
The tax assessment is for $286,500, he said. Another house in our neighborhood, a cape like ours, just sold for $315,000.
Odd. How much land do you have? Is it possible that this McClovick guy is a developer and he thinks he can subdivide your lot? Marvin shifted in his seat and played with his wedding ring.
I don't see how. We only have a quarter acre. The house is in the front of the lot. Emily's garden is in the back. A driveway is on the side.
Cam nodded and asked the obvious question. Don't take this wrong, but if he's offering you $100,000 more than the house is worth, why don't you take it?
Mr. Thorne, Emily said in a low voice, as my husband stated, we do not wish to move. We have lived our whole lives in Westford. Our friends are here. Our church is here. Marvin comes here to the senior center for card games. I have my garden. When we die, the house will go to our church.
Marvin nodded. Okay, then. But I thought McClovick said something about a signed agreement.
He somehow forged Marvin's signature.
A young lady came to the door a week or so ago collecting signatures for a senior citizen property tax refund. Marvin signed that. Perhaps he was tricked.
You're certain there's nothing else?
Nothing.
Well, he could always file a lawsuit against you and try to force you to sell. If he does, we'll fight it, of course. But until then, just don't sign any documents without showing them to me first.
He smiled and clicked his pen closed. Even petitions. More than a legal problem, this was a mystery. Why was McClovick willing to pay $100,000 more than the house was worth, and then get so angry that he resorted to near fisticuffs when Cam interfered?
Cam continued. But you do have some legal options. You could file an assault case against him for grabbing Mr. Gendron's wrist, or we could get a restraining order against him.
Marvin sat tall in his chair. He frightened my wife, Mr. Thorne, and Emily does not frighten easily. We do not want this McClovick fellow near us or our property again.
All right. Meet me back here tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. By late afternoon, you should have your restraining order.
Thursday. Cam obtained the temporary restraining order for Mr. and Mrs. Gendron the morning after their first meeting. The order prohibited McClovick from contacting the older couple and from going within 100 feet of their property. But due process demanded that McClovick be given his day in court as well. Today, a week later, he would have the chance to give his side of the story and try to convince the judge to vacate the order. What was McClovick's angle? When people tossed around $100,000 like a frisbee, there was usually a good reason. Cam himself was a case in point. He took a $120,000 pay cut to come work for his uncle. Not that he had much choice. At 36, he had been working for one of those mega firms in Boston where everyone drove a Lexus. The firm was defending the local archdiocese in a batch of priest sexual abuse cases, and Cam was assigned to the case. Part of the defense strategy developed by the lead attorney involved intimidating abuse victims with embarrassing information culled from their medical records. One afternoon, he watched a grown man sob during a particularly ugly deposition session. On the verge of making partner, Cam reached one of those fork-in-the-road moments and made a phone call leaking details of the sordid defense strategy to the press. A week later, he got caught. Lawyers are nothing if not self-important, and in the legal world, few sins are considered more grave than disloyalty to a client. Instead of a piece of the partnership pie, he ended up with a temporary suspension of his law license and an exile to the suburbs. That was the story behind Cam's six-figure folly. What was McClovick's? Cam met with Mr. and Mrs. Gendron a few minutes before 10 o'clock at the Lowell Superior Court. The commanding stone structure hearkened to Lowell's glory days. Few people knew that Lowell, not Boston, had been Massachusetts' leading city in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a world leader in textile manufacturing. Today, it was a struggling mill city trying to reinvent itself through high-tech industry and a revitalized downtown. They climbed the long marble staircase to the second floor, the tread grayed and worn from decades of use. Cam was not surprised to see McClavick standing.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?